this WJBC This Week.
We will not stand another day, another week, another month. Something has to be done at this intersection.
If we just put a four-way stop in there, doesn't mean we're going to reduce all the accidents.
I leave here with sadness and humility. For those whom I've let down, I will work tirelessly to make it up to you.
Not only, by the way, did the president not just consult us, he was obligated by law to notify us of this, and he didn't do that either.
This is WJBC This Week, where we look back at the top news stories and interviews from the past week. I'm Eric Stock. On this week's program, State Senator Bill Brady discusses his proposal to privatize public colleges and universities in Illinois, a lesson in mental resilience from a former Navy SEAL and a vet suffering from PTSD. A rape victim shares how she became best friends with a man she helped to send to prison for a crime he didn't commit. A gun instructor mother explains how you can safely carry your baby and your weapon at the same time. And an author offers help for someone who has a gambling addict in their family. That and more coming up. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. Jennifer Thompson was a senior in college when she was raped at gunpoint in 1984. The man she identified as her attacker, Ronald Cotton, was sent to life in prison only to be exonerated and released from prison a decade later, based on a DNA sample she provided. Their unlikely friendship became the basis for the best-selling book, Picking Cotton. They will be the keynote speakers on April 7th at Illinois State University as part of Science and Technology Week. And Thompson talked with the WJBC's Susan Saunders this week.
How did this come about that you are now friends with Ronald Cotton, a man that you had previously identified as your attacker and rapist?
Well, when Ronald was released in June of 1995, I watched the news like everybody else. Ronald had been the first North Carolina DNA exonerate. And so I watched him, walk out of prison and be exonerated. And I watched, over the next few months as things began to unfold for him. And, for me, of course, it was a great deal of anxiety. There was fear that he would retaliate. There was guilt over, my memory having failed me. And so I just kind of did what most people do in these circumstances, which was nothing, because I was afraid. A year would go by, and we were asked to help do a documentary about the fallibility of eyewitness ID. It was done by Frontline PBS, and my only demand was that Ronald and I not do it together in the same town, because I was, again, afraid and terrified that he would somehow want revenge. They did the piece. It was titled What Jennifer Saw. It aired on February 25th of 1997. And as I watched it, my last words were, I know that he's innocent, but I still see his face in my nightmares. And the last thing Ronald says is, I know she's sorry, but I really need to hear that from her. And that was the big aha moment for me, that I needed to meet the man, because I didn't know the man. I had only created this monster in my head, and at the least he deserved, my God, was an apology. And that led me to ask for a meeting, a private meeting for the two of us in a church about a mile and a half from where I'd been raped that 13 years before. And he agreed. He came, and I apologized with everything that I had, and Ronald, with all the grace and mercy in the world, just started to cry and took my hands, and he said, I forgave you years ago, Jennifer. And it was that moment where I really, for the first time as a survivor of violence, began to start healing. And we talked about our experiences having traveled through the judicial system and our experiences of being the victims of Bobby Poole, who was my assailant, who not only had raped me, but a second woman right after me. And then, of course, we left him out in the streets for the rest of the year, where he then further committed many other rapes and assaults and breaking and enterings. and was finally apprehended in April of 1985. But what we really realized is that we had more in common than not. We had been failed, and we had been hurt, and we had been traumatized. And that gave us a place to begin forming a relationship to where we are now, which is best of friends, and we love each other completely and totally. I mean, I've known him on some level for 31 years of my life.
It was 1984. You were a junior or a senior in college at that time?
I would be going into my senior year, yes.
Going into your senior year. At that point in time, what were you planning on doing with your life? What was your goal before this assault?
Well, I was dating a guy. I've been dating him for about 2 years. We were talking about getting married, and I was working. I had two jobs, and I was also a 4.0 student, so I was going to be graduating at the top of my class the following spring and had planned to go on to graduate school for exercise physiology. I wanted to be a physical therapist.
At that same time, what was Ronald Cotton doing?
Well, Ronald was, we were both the same age, so he was 22 and I was 22. I think he, you know, worked a couple of jobs. He was dating a girl. And Ron would tell you, his words were, I was a party guy. You know, I partied every night of the week. And I think one of his sayings that he's used a couple of times is, I needed to slow my Mustang down. So he was, you know, being a typical 22-year-old guy. He was just kind of, you know, out.
How had he been so confused as your attacker? Had your description been turned into a poster or some sort of artist sketch, and that's how someone looked at Ron and said, it's that guy? Or had you seen him and pointed to him? How did it turn into him being accused?
Well, I had actually gotten a very good look at my assailant. He was there for quite a long period of time, and so my description was very, very accurate, which led to a police officer asking if I could do a composite sketch. And at that point in time, they used something called an identikit, which was a big box of facial features. So you'd go through the eyebrows, and you pick out the eyebrows you think you remember, and the nose and the ears and the chin, to put together the composite sketch, which ran in the newspaper. And a phone call came in hours after running in the newspaper from a woman who said the sketch looked like a guy she knew by the name of Ronald Cotton. And she went on to say that she had seen him around 3 o'clock in the morning on July 29th, which was the day and the time I was raped, outside of my apartment complex, wearing the exact clothes I had described my assailant wearing. And that led the police to then put Ronald in as, you know, obviously a prime suspect, put him in the photographic lineup, which I was then able to pick him out. And that led to a physical lineup a few days later after the photo lineup. And again, I picked him out of the physical lineup. And it's important for the listeners to know that one of the problems with that was Bobby Poole was not in the lineup. And so what I did was, and it's natural and it's very subconscious, is you pick the next best choice, right?
Mm-hmm.
And well, that's what happened.
Bobby Poole had not been arrested at that point in time for any assaults, correct?
That is correct. That is correct. And when I picked out Ronald out of the photograph, the officers said to me, good job, that's who we thought it was.
We're talking with Jennifer Thompson, who, along with Ronald Cotton, will be the keynote speakers at Illinois State University in the Prairie Room Bone Student Center on Tuesday, April 7th, as part of the Science and Technology Week at Illinois State University. And Jennifer had accidentally falsely accused Ronald Cotton of assault and rape in 1984, and Ronald Cotton spent 11 years in prison until he was cleared by DNA testing, and together the two have forged a bond that has turned into now a lifelong friendship. They speak at colleges, campuses, public venues all over the country, and their story has even become the basis of a New York Times bestselling book called Picking Cotton. When Poole was arrested, you said that was 1985?
Right, yes.
At that point in time, there was no investigation of connecting his assaults to your case?
No. You know, so oftentimes I think police and prosecutors and sometimes public defenders have this, what they call tunnel vision. You know, they focus. They can't see anything outside of the box. That's all they see. Once Ronald was, you know, picked at a lineup and held for trial and then convicted, I think in their heads they thought, well, you know, we got the right guy. This is just a second guy out doing copycat crimes. You know, at the time in the 80s, people weren't really trying to understand fallibility of memory. And still today, so many people think that a victim or witness's memory is absolutely, you know, surefire evidence that they got it right. And it's hard to question a victim or witness when they're on the stand saying, that's the face I remember, I'll never forget it as long as I live. It's very compelling evidence, and jurors love it. And yet it's the most fallible, suggestible type of evidence that we know is out there. And it's very prone to be wrong.
That was ISU keynote speaker Jennifer Thompson with our Susan Saunders. State Senator Bill Brady raised some eyebrows with what he called a bold idea to change how public colleges would operate in the state. He wants to essentially privatize them and compel students who leave the state shortly after graduation to repay the grants they received. Brady shared his proposal with the WJBC's Scott Laughlin and Colleen Reynolds this week.
I've got two questions for you. Number one, and these come from listeners here. I'm supposed to ask a couple of questions when it comes to your proposal we'll talk about in a second here, privatizing basically state schools. Have you taken a blow to the head with a blunt object was one, and another one asked you if you had a stroke. So
well,
that's the initial reaction from your constituents, at least the ones I know.
Yeah, well, it's I will admit it is a bold initiative, and certainly one that takes a lot of people by surprise. But it really came out of when I ran for governor 4 or 5 years ago, sitting down and visiting with presidents of public and private universities around the state, who talked about the huge burden that was placed on them due to government regulations that only affected those public universities, their ability to compete and thrive, and the fact that I think this is about strengthening those current public universities by thinking out of the box in order to better help the students, not to mention the faculty and the economy of the state.
All right, so let's talk about the details, and this would pertain to all of the state schools, your Southerns, your Easterns, your Westerns, your Northern, am I missing you? Chicago State, Governor State, and Illinois State, of course. The amendment says that each university's board of trustees would have to devise a plan to slowly relinquish its authority and appoint a governing board to replace itself. Well, right there, it sounds like that's not gonna fly.
Well, the plan calls for at least a six-year implementation, and again, I'm not proposing that this is the end-all solution. What I am proposing is we need to discuss, are there ways in which our current public universities could be better serving our students and the taxpayers, building stronger economies, building stronger faculties? So one of the ways to do that would be to implement a plan to make them non-for-profit private institutions like Illinois Wesleyan, Northwestern, Bradley University. This state is blessed with very strong private institutions that have a thriving faculty, student base, economic force in our state.
Well, it sounds as though you're saying to public universities, you take state money, but what are you giving back?
That's not what I'm saying, Kelly. What I'm saying is there's several wins here, in my opinion. One of them is that we free their hands to do what they think their local board thinks is best for the students, the faculty, and Illinois' economy. I think we have a better ability to do that in many circumstances in those private institutions because we don't constrict them the same way we do our current public universities.
But didn't we do away with the Board of Regents and give them more local control?
Pardon me?
Well, I thought we gave universities more local control when we did away with the Board of Regents and they were allowed to have their own Board of Trustees.
There's, again, part of what this would do would help us fully examine. One of the problems that I've had in trying to prepare for the introduction of this legislation is it's not as easy as you would think to identify the financial restrictions we place on them, the regulations that are placed. So one of the things this does is it opens the discussion and about what can we do to give them more local control, like a private university, Illinois Western, as I said, Northwestern and other ones that have. So part of the discussion is let's examine it. It's not as easy as you would think to really put a price tag on that. But, you know, we gave more direct control when we eliminated the Board of Regents. I was proud to have been a part of that. I think that helped strengthen Illinois State University by giving its own board as opposed to a board that shared governance over several public universities. This would simply be a step further in that direction. I mean, I think that if you look at our strong private, non-for-profit universities, you can see a model that would be a win-win for the current public universities,
so
be the economy,
let's talk,
faculty, and students.
Let's talk money here. So if this were to fly, then the state of Illinois would no longer funnel money to these universities? It would only get there
not
in the way
all.
Of MAP grants?
Well, right now, the state of Illinois directly funds our current public universities and additionally funds public and private universities through what are called MAP grants, Monetary Assistance Program, and gives aid to those students who need it to attend both public and private. This would take that money and from both pots and provide money in the form of grants to both public and private universities to fund that education for those students that need it. It also would serve one of the issues that concerns many is that when we pay for some of those MAP grants now, there's no obligation that the student graduate. This would forgive those grants in their entirety, one half upon graduation, and an additional one-eighth per year the graduate would work in our state. So what it does is it helps work to attract students to our universities. We're losing a lot of students to outside universities. We've educated and they've grown up in our state for, you know, K through 12, and we're losing some of them to outside public universities right now, which gives us concern. Secondly, when they graduate, they leave. This gives motivation and incentive to graduate and stay in our state.
So
it gives the taxpayers a greater guarantee of a return on their investment.
That was State Senator Bill Brady with Scott and Colleen. As more American troops return home from wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, the problem of post-traumatic stress disorder becomes more prevalent as the soldiers and their families face a new kind of challenge. Former Navy SEAL Eric Greitens, a Purple Heart recipient, encountered that in some of the soldiers he came to know. One of them, Zach Walker, spiraled into alcoholism when he returned home. Greitens discussed how he helped Zach reclaim his life and provides lessons in mental resilience when he talked with the WJBC's Steve Fast this week.
What is it that they need to do? Is it something that you have to be involved with continuing to serve in some way?
That is the right question. Because what happens is, yes, there is in sometimes in a few places, there is a place where medication can be helpful. But what we found working with thousands of veterans around the country is that the things that really make a difference are often much simpler. So, for example, you know, I said to Zach, one part of the problem right now is that you don't feel like you're needed. You don't feel like you have any sense of purpose. And this happens not just to veterans when they come home. It happens to people when they retire. It happens to people when their kids leave for college. It happens to kids when they leave home. People struggle in these transitions. So I said to Zach, I said, you got to get out and you have to start serving again. Zach went out and he had a friend who asked him to volunteer and do a little coaching. He did that, and now Zach is actively coaching. He coached football last fall. He's coaching baseball this spring. He's got his home opener on April 4th. And he said, when I'm out there with the kids and they're looking at me and they want me to be strong, he becomes stronger. So, you know, you find a way to build a sense of purpose by taking that kind of action. And there are lots of other things that people can do in a really practical way. We talk about a practice of gratitude, how that helps people. We talk about the fact that exercise helps people. We talk about how people can take responsibility for things, even when a lot of the world seems out of control, and how that gives them a sense for control moving forward. So, yes, there can be a place in some circumstances for medication, but too often what we're finding with the VA and in so much of our culture is that people think they can solve these problems with a pill. And what you really need to have is you need to draw on the fact there's a lot of ancient wisdom out there that we can draw on today and really take control of our own lives.
Before you became a SEAL, before you joined the Navy, you were doing humanitarian work. And, you know, yeah. As I mentioned before, you did pretty well in school. You're a Rhodes Scholar. So is there something that you figured out early on about service that led you and took you on this path? And did you figure that out early and then everything's good? Or have you had to remind yourself about some of these very same things that you were writing Zach about over the years?
Well, you know, first of all, I was very fortunate when I was doing a lot of humanitarian work overseas. I saw how families built resilience. You know, one of the first places where I worked when I was 20 years old, I was working with refugee families. They were fleeing from Bosnia. They'd lost every material possession they'd ever owned. They'd lost their homes. They landed in refugee camps. And one of the things that I saw, Steve, was that oftentimes the people who were doing the best in the refugee camps were oftentimes parents and grandparents who had really young kids. Because it meant that they had to get up every day and be strong for someone else. And so you started to see there how actually having a purpose beyond yourself actually makes you stronger in the face of pain. And there are a lot of lessons, you know, about, you know, that I saw kind of working with kids who'd been abandoned and abused, kids who'd lost limbs to landmines, and all of that is in the book as well. And for myself, absolutely, this is not something that you kind of hear once and then you never need to learn again. One of the things actually, and again, the ancients recognized this, they said that a lot of philosophy is about reminding yourself of things that you might already know. And so what we've done in the resilience book is that we've taken a lot of this practical wisdom and put it in places in such a way that people can remind themselves about how you take responsibility, how you build a sense of purpose in the face of pain. And I've had to use it many times in my own life. I mean, one of the fun current challenges that I've got and the great joy is that I'm a father now. I got an 8-month-old son, and it's absolutely beautiful to have him here. But of course, as anybody knows who's had kids, it can be tough at times as well.
That was former Navy SEAL Eric Greitens with our Steve Fast. Today's local news is next. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. Guns and children are usually not considered a wise combination, but both can be cared for simultaneously and safely, according to Melanie Lauer, a mother of three young children and a certified gun safety instructor in Des Moines, Iowa. She started teaching a class on gun safety for mothers of young children. She talked with the WJBC's Scott Lachlan and Colleen Reynolds this week.
Obviously, you carry a gun and a child. And how did this all start? Because you work at a gun range and you work at a child care facility?
Well, actually, that was way back when I first started carrying. I've been carrying a gun for 9 years now. I've been a firearms instructor now for 8. And I've been a mother for 6 years, obviously. Back when I started, or even before I had children, I was working at a gun range and a parenting center in Virginia. And that's kind of where I got a little bit of experience in both firearms and in kind of the attachment parenting kind of style of parenting.
So you figure there are moms out there, dads too, I suppose, that are carrying their kids around, and they're also carrying guns and probably not doing it safely. So you thought, hey, I've got an idea here, and it's taken off, huh?
Well, I know for a fact a lot of them are not doing it safely. I'm also the administrator of an online group for moms who carry guns. And this is a relatively new thing. It's only about 6 months old or so, and maybe a little bit longer. And we have over 4,000 members. And seeing the pictures of people carrying guns and carrying babies, saying things like, is this safe? Is this okay? What about this? I decided to try this. Is this good? And a lot of times, not all the time, but a lot of times I'd see something that was not safe or something that was not a very optimal way to do either. And so I started thinking about this concept of what if we could have a class where these people who've never done anything like this before can come and get instruction from someone who is qualified to teach about firearm safety, but also knows about the needs of attachment parenting lifestyle. And the original concept was just to come together and just share some ideas. But then when I saw the type of people who were registering for the class, I made it a much more kind of half-formal, half-informal class. The first part was definitely talking about safe handling, safe storage, and what constitutes safe carry, and then going into the workshop portion where they can actually try holsters and just see what works out for them. We didn't have any children in the class, and everything that we used as far as the guns were concerned were inert dummy guns.
Let me ask you first, I think for people listening, they might not be familiar with the attachment parenting approach. So why don't you explain that a little bit?
Attachment parenting is just basically kind of like peaceful parenting. It's all about, you know, wearing your child, responding immediately to your child's needs, not letting them cry it out, those kinds of things. Just a very, you know, extended breastfeeding, natural parenting kind of style.
So what's, you talk about a safe way to carry a child and a gun. What are you teaching them? I mean, obviously there's a lot of bad things. How do you do it?
Well, one of the main important, main important things is that safe handling, making sure that you have your safe handling down so you're not doing something irresponsible as far as covering yourself with your firearm or, you know, having the muzzle sweep yourself and keeping your finger off the trigger, pointing it in the safe direction, keeping it holstered at all times, not playing with your firearm if you don't need to. The other big portion of it is keeping it in a quality holster. There are a lot of really, really bad holsters out there that are being marketed because they're cheap and they're easy and to buy, whereas a good quality holster, like anything, will cost you a little money. But people who don't know the difference between quality and something that's not quality will just buy something cheap, and they don't understand the safety risks involved in that. So I spend almost a good 30 minutes just talking about what constitutes a quality holster.
That was gun instructor Melody Lauer with our Scott and Colleen. Putting down a few bucks for your NCAA tournament pool seems harmless, and for most of us it is. But there are many forms of seemingly innocent games of chance that could trigger an addiction. Damon Dye, the author of Know When to Hold Them, offers tips on how to help a family member struggling with a gambling addiction, as he talked with the WJBC's Terry James this week.
I've heard people compare slot machine players to zombies because they can let time pass, hours will pass, and they're still just staring at the screen.
Many individuals who end up problem gambling, which in fact 45% of problem gamblers are women.
Why is that?
Well, if you look at from what we see, you know, for an individual who's struggling emotionally or maybe just was introduced to the games, you know, at a later age, you know, just socially, 97% of the population are fine, can gamble without any problems. But 3%, 1% to 2%, those individuals do find that it's a problem for them. You know, we wonder, is that part of the human condition? Is that part of, you know, everyone has strengths and weaknesses? We all, you know, have our vulnerabilities. But once someone enters into that venue where now it's they are engaged in playing more often, now they're hooked in, how to walk away because the force is so powerful. So for a lot of women who go, you know, it's a safe activity, it's something social, it's something to do, and then before you know it, it's progressive like drugs and alcohol, and they find themselves caught up just as men do.
ADHD in the book, Know When to Hold 'Em. Again, we're talking with author Damon Dye. In your book, you link ADHD to problem gambling. Why is that?
Well, you know, if you look at, you know, risk-taking, if you look at a lot of individuals who, you know, are very emotionally sensitive, I think, you know, that's a good thing, you know, to be able to have emotional intelligence and to be able to read people, to be involved, you know, in interacting with others on an emotional level. But, you know, you're also dealing with impulsive behaviors. You're also dealing with, you know, focus, you know, as a challenge where, you know, you can multitask. You know, I can get a lot of things done. And, in fact, if you look at a lot of successful people, many people who are successful have ADHD, ADHD-like characteristics. And so it's just been very fascinating to look at, you know, how high-functioning people get a lot done. But interesting that, you know, a lot of them, you know, in, when they enter into problem gambling, it creates a difficulty for them because of their characteristics.
Especially timely right now is the NCAA tournament, brackets, multiple brackets. Where do the problems lie here? And is this the start or a continuation of problem gambling, those who enter these pools?
Well, you know, most people can gamble fine. So, you know, a bracket is kind of a morale or a team building or just an annual event where, you know, it gets people together and gets people talking and exciting. So it can be, you know, a fun activity for a workplace, you know, when you're dealing with a lot of stress. So the majority of folks are fine. But, you know, for those that do have a problem or are vulnerable to a problem, it can become an issue. For those who are maybe in recovery, you know, who are sports bettors, who, you know, have a hard enough time trying to go throughout the day, trying to enjoy sports, but without wagering or looking at lines, you know, March Madness becomes a challenge because, you know, now you're engaging in something that just seems so socially acceptable. And that's fine for everyone else, but for you, it's a trigger. And so when you're trying to manage that, oftentimes in secrecy, because there's a lot of stigma regarding problem gambling, as you mentioned, it's not easy to talk about it. So that person's often trying to manage, resist, you know, engaging in, you know, not doing a bracket, and people are questioning. So it becomes almost like a situation where they kind of go along with it, trying to minimize so that they aren't embarrassed or bring additional attention to themselves.
Before we get to solutions, I just want to ask you about one thing that I know a lot of teenagers are doing, which is Texas Hold'em poker in their parents' basements. And many parents think this is harmless. But is this not the beginning to a problem down the road?
You know, problem gambling in general is something that's just widely accepted is okay. But, you know, in states it can be illegal, you know, under the age of 18 to gamble. And so, you know, of course, parents are, you know, it's difficult to parent. You're trying to raise your children and trying to keep them away from drugs and alcohol and keep them at home. And, you know, an activity such as, you know, cards, especially when it's on ESPN and it's exciting, absolutely. Parents go, yeah, why not? You know, this is fantastic. They're at home. They're enjoying it. And so, again, 97% of the population are fine. But there are statistics that show when we introduce children to gambling earlier on, you know, it can increase the risk. Not necessarily that they'll become a problem gambler, but when you look at the statistics of who did become, they were introduced early on, and they oftentimes, you know, have had a big win.
Your book is a guide for spouses of problem gamblers. So how do the spouses of problem gamblers know that they are facing a problem with their loved ones?
So a partner often is the first one to enter treatment or the first one to enter into a GA group where, you know, they're going, hey, something's not right here. I can't get a feel for it. I think that there's something else going on. So oftentimes there's a lot of confusion. There's detection that there's personality changes. There's detection that there's secrecy about the money. They may be aware gambling's going on, but not sure if it's a problem. Usually there's a lot of lying going on, a lot of secrecy. So, you know, the partner, many times is finding out in a shocking way, like finding out over time that maybe, they happenly got a statement on the retirement that they got a hold of, or they noticed some changes with cash being withdrawn. And so they're starting to piece together a lot of clues. So it's not always easy to detect. And so then creates a new element where they feel guilty or feel like they should have seen it earlier or start taking additional responsibility for it. And so that's a challenge for a partner. And even identifying it, it's not always easy because, you know, a lot of these individuals, very good people, And because of the nature of problem gambling, are pretty good at hiding it. So you have an added element of challenge for them.
And then what do you do once you've identified that there is a problem? How do you start the process of getting better?
I believe it's important to reach out for resources. You know, this is a very difficult, this can be a very difficult addiction. And so it's not something that can just be stopped. And of course, you know, we want someone to be able to find ways to get away from something so powerful. But this, as mentioned earlier, is a biochemical response. This is very powerful. And so I suggest getting involved with a treatment professional, finding someone in your area to talk to find out, well, what are we really dealing with? How much of a problem is this? And finding someone to help, you know, me as well. Like, what do I do? We have the kids at home. How do I manage the responsibilities? Should I be angry? I am angry. But if I'm angry, I'm more just going to send him back to the casino. And so a lot of questions need to be answered. So getting someone involved who's a professional. And then, you know, looking at Gamblers Anonymous support groups, you know, talking to other people, you know, can help. Because you often feel alone. You feel like, you know, it's because of the stigma, we don't talk a lot about this. And so because of that, you know, there's just a feeling of isolation. So I encourage finding online resources, getting to a support group, and finding a local professional.
That was author Damon Dye with our Terry James. The Weekend News is next. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. Time now for the Weekend News. A man died earlier this month in a crash at the intersection of Bunn and Lincoln Streets in Bloomington. And WJBC's Joe Ragusa reports residents of that area want to see something done about the intersection.
Many residents, like Sue Feldkamp, don't like how the intersection is currently configured, with stop signs on Bunn Street, but not Lincoln.
I want to know why we need an advisory board on this when common sense says it all.
City officials, including Assistant City Engineer Bob Yale and Assistant City Manager Steve Rasmussen, told over 100 people at a meeting Thursday that officials are studying the intersection and a possible solution could be enacted in mid-April at the earliest. Joe Ragusa, WJBC and WJBC.com.
Governor Rauner signed legislation on Thursday after a pair of bills were adopted by the Senate to fill a gap in the current fiscal budget. State Senator Jason Berrickman says it wasn't easy to fill a $1.6 billion hole. In order to get the job done, the bill calls for a more than 2% funding cut to nearly every state program.
I think these cuts are going to be felt in every community around the state, but they're also a necessary step that allows us to maintain our core services.
Without the measures, child care providers, court reporters, and prison guards are all at risk of not getting paid. The Illinois National Guard has revoked the security clearance of a guardsman from Aurora who's accused of trying to fly overseas to join ISIS. Hassan Edmonds was arrested late Wednesday at Midway Airport in Chicago. Hassan's cousin, Jonas Edmonds, was arrested and charged with plotting to damage a military facility in Joliet on behalf of ISIS. Guard spokesman Lieutenant Colonel Brad Layton says if Hassan Edmonds had asked for help for personal issues, he would have received it.
If our National Guardsmen or airmen are having personal difficulties or mental difficulties, there are resources out there for them. We do have a psychological director and things along those lines, but that's talking in generalities and not about this particular incident.
The two cousins are due back in court next week. Two 18-year-olds who attend Normal Community High School are accused of setting up a bottle bomb in the basement of a classmate. The two students are athletes at Normal Community. Dwayne Farrington was arraigned on felony trespassing and misdemeanor reckless conduct charges the same day he played with the Ironmen in the state basketball semifinals. Farrington and Brady Quackenbush, a golfer at NCHS, were arrested in February. The state's attorney's office accuses the two teens of knocking on a classmate's window to scare them, then coming back a couple hours later with household cleaner and a bottle. The chemical reaction caused an explosion that left over $300 in damages. Farrington is due back in court April 24th, Quackenbush on May 6th. Congressman Adam Kinzinger says President Obama broke the law in trading five terrorists for Sergeant Bo Bergdahl.
Not only, by the way, did the president not just consult us, he was obligated by law to notify us of this, and he didn't do that either.
Bergdahl was formally charged with desertion this week. Kinzinger was guest on Fox News' On the Record. Bergdahl's attorney attorney released a letter about the former prisoner's time with the Taliban. Bergdahl sent a letter to General Mark Milley saying his captors were cruel and abused him. McLean County health officials say they're generally satisfied with the new study, which ranks the county 30th in the state for overall health, but the obesity rate remains high at 31%. County Health Department spokeswoman Lisa Slater tells WJBC's Scott Laughlin the health department wants to educate restaurants and the public about portion control.
If they'll give me more, that's better. I want to order this instead of that because look at how much more there is. And really, there was a lack of kind of reality of how much do you really need.
An outgoing Congressman Aaron Schock gave a farewell speech on the U.S. House floor on Thursday. Schock says he leaves Congress with sadness and humility.
I believe that through life struggles, we learn from our mistakes and we learn more about ourselves.
Schock resigned amid questions about his spending practices with taxpayer and campaign dollars. His last day in office will be Tuesday. Up next, the week to come. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. Now we look ahead at the week to come. On Tuesday, police, fire, medical, and emergency management personnel will conduct an emergency response exercise at ISU's decommissioned South Campus Residence Hall complex. Wednesday will mark National Walking Day. ISU will mark the occasion with campus walk, health activities, and prizes. Also Wednesday, the Bloomington Public Library is expected to hire an architect for a library expansion study. On Thursday, Lieutenant Governor Evelyn Sanguinetti will be keynote speaker at the McLean County Republican Lincoln Dinner in Bloomington. And next Sunday is opening day of the baseball season. The St. Louis Cardinals will open the 2015 season at Wrigley Field against the Chicago Cubs. This has been WJBC This Week. To listen to this week's program again, go to the WJBC.com podcast page. I'm Eric Stock.